Walmart is busting to oppose something called COOL, origin labeling. Walmart does, and it pertains to meat. Want you to know where it gets its meat. On the ironics, Chinese poison in the hog food story that came up last week, it might be the United States that they don't, but not likely. But it's years ago I was in Wally World and picked up a package of hamburger with beef flavor added. It was then that I found out water to beef to increase the weight constitutes beef, as long as you dissolve one cube of bouillon in 800 gallons of water. The meat came from. They're busting their humps to get, and that's part and parcel of this the Franken beef. Does that make your eyes just you know kind of get a little sort of a loosey goosey feeling to them, and like they're going to just kind of roll back in the head, and you're going to go, does this give you one of those? The FDA, because after all, the FDA is, you know, since it's involved with the Bush admin, part of the Bush administration, by definition run by some shill from the one lobby or another, who came in and, we don't need those stinking labels. What do they want to know if it's cloned for? That's why it's cloned. It's all the damn same. Makes no sense to clone one's the same as clone two's, the same as clone three is the... That's the problem. It isn't. Because it's the same principle that applies to, off with the clean copy, you copy it once, you copy the copy, you copy the copy of the copy. And quality goes down, 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 down. Anybody that's ever worked in any kind of audio understands that tape, if you copied once, generation copy, okay. But you lose a little more on the second generation copy, and you fourth, and on the fifth, on all these analog recordings. Well, guess what? Cows are analog. Weird things will begin to happen from generation two to generation three down to generation, among which is the fact that the food supply will be found profound jeopardy. Kraft, Lord, you know, we've got a government that spends your money putting these out. Risk assessment, we call that the DACRA, the Draft Animal Cloning Risk Assessment. Cloned animals are as safe to eat as other food, which, because the other food is pretty well, damn well poisoned by now, too. I mean, it's a lie, but it's not a lie. You know, because that's how they think it. Yeah, consumer groups. They say that there's not enough, that enough research into the possible risks of human done. Enough? How about any? Throw it on the grill there, Bobby. Tastes like cow to me. Safe! Meanwhile, in Post, the FDA, quote, has known for years about contamination at a Georgia peanut butter plant and on California spinach farms that led to disease outbreaks that... But because we are, it's involved in, it's part of an administration, they were going to rely on the free market. Going to rely on the capitalist system, all the producers to police themselves, because, you know, that's how you do best. When, yep. Put that in another context. How about the FBI has decided to allow terror? Or the New York police has declared that burglars should be allowed to police themselves. You see, burglars aren't burglars until they get caught burgling. Up until then, they're just another innocent until presumed guilty citizen. A polluter, a corporate poisoner, is not a poisoner, or as they're policing themselves. Guess what? You're not going to get caught. And you're going to sit that has been rinsed in caca. And you're going to wonder, you're going to start wondering, my, that's kind of odd. I'm bleeding where I ought not be. You've got yourself a healthy little case of poisoning via E. coli. You're screwed. Same with peanut butter. How does 7 on it? Do you know where E. coli 1? Here's a hint. It doesn't it doesn't live on nice shiny laboratory countertops. Here's a bigger hint. Out on the factory farms of Kansas and Nebraska, cattle stand fetlock deep. Is that a word, fetlock? In the stuff that is a breeding ground for E. coli 157H7. That's right, poopy! Peanut butter gets E. coli 157H7 because it's been exposed to poop! Same thing with spinach. Poop! Same thing with hamburgers. Poop! That's where it comes from. It's just a little, E. coli 157H7 condominium poop. But you see, the free market guarantees that producers will police themselves because they are honest and would not say poop if they had a mouthful. Obviously, they didn't say poop, and they did have a mouthful. See? It works. All right, news time. We'll be back. Hey, light it up. E. coli 157H7. That's the phone number. E. coli 157H7. Nah, it's 877-443-2366. Or on your nickel, 304-658-5453. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn.
This is the Quality News Network. The Dow Jones hit another record today, closing over 13,200. We'll have the details and numbers coming up in our business segment. Congress failed to override President Bush's veto of the war spending bill today. The bill called for a timetable for troop withdrawal from Iraq. Democrats did not have the two-thirds majority needed for that override. A day after President Bush vetoed that war spending bill, he's meeting with a bipartisan group of congressional leaders to work on a new solution. About 4,000 American troops will be deployed in Iraq this week as part of the troop surge. The aim of the increased troops is to help quell the sectarian violence raging in Baghdad. Across Iraq today, at least 85 people were killed in violence. Tomorrow, a regional conference will be held in Egypt to discuss the security situation in Iraq. Authorities in Iran have arrested that country's former nuclear negotiator, Hossein Mousavian. Officials are not releasing any details, but an Iranian news agency reports he could face espionage charges. Mousavian was an ally of the previous president, who was a rival of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And Turkey's prime minister asked Parliament today to approve an earlier date for national elections. He asked for a June 24th election instead of the scheduled November 4th date. The prime minister is pressing for other changes as well that would give advantages to his Islamic party over Turkey's secular politicos. There are high-level calls for Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to resign after Monday's release of a highly critical review of how he handled the war against Hezbollah last summer. Israel's foreign minister is the latest top official to ask the prime minister to step down. Prime Minister Tony Blair, meanwhile, announced today he will be giving up his post in a few weeks. Blair told a crowd at a Labour Party rally on the 10th anniversary of his election. French voters go to the polls on Sunday in the runoff presidential election between Gaullist candidate Nicolas Sarkozy and socialist candidate Ségolène Royal. The U.S. Republican presidential candidates meet at the Reagan Library tomorrow for their first debate. Last Thursday, the Democrat candidates squared off in South Carolina. Police in Los Angeles will review their use of force after violence broke out at an immigration rally yesterday. You're listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business.
We want you to know about an honest source of information on one of the country's most desirable vacation destinations, Carmel by the Sea, on California's beautiful central coast. That source is the best address in Carmel, carmel.com. Just a few simple keystrokes and you're visiting a beautiful website that mirrors all that Carmel stands for. Quality, character, tradition, beauty, the great outdoors by the sea, cultural heritage, quiet, and the best shops, charming inns, superb dining, world-class art, music, and theater, a cornucopia of delights. So when you're planning your next getaway, go to the best address in Carmel, carmel.com, for tips on everything Carmel. Then put that honest information to good use by visiting Carmel by the Sea for an unforgettable getaway. Carmel.com.
The Food and Drug Administration wants to expand a warning for antidepressants for young adults ages 18 to 24. The FDA says there's an increased risk of suicidal behavior during the first month of taking antidepressants. The current warning now includes only children and adolescents. The National Interagency Fire Center predicts that drought and higher than usual temperatures may make for a severe fire season this year in the west and southeast. Police have arrested four JetBlue airline employees and a New York corrections officer for shopping sprees paid by credit cards accidentally left by passengers dashing to catch their flights. Fortune magazine reports that fired radio talk show host Don Imus plans to sue to recover the $40 million CBS Radio still owes him on his contract. He has hired a top-notch First Amendment attorney. Imus was fired for racially offensive remarks he made about the women on the Rutgers basketball team. AAA reports since early April, gasoline prices have gone up 30 cents a gallon. Light sweet crude is trading at $63.68 a barrel. The Dow traded in record territory today. It closed at up 76 points at 13,211. And the NASDAQ was up 26 points. The S&P was up 10. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Laurel Krissen.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Coming up on 6 minutes after, I'm Bob. And an email rolled in. Sort of an observation, sort of a query. Namely, Warren Zevon's skills were at a peak when Granddaddy Evil, Old Ronnie, was seducing first California and then the nation. So Warren's work was falling on too many right-facing ears. There is some of that. And you know, frankly, that takes us to another place. And it's kind of, you know, this isn't celebrity journalism. I wanted Crystal Zevon on here because There is stuff within this book that is closely associated to the stuff we talk about here. You know why some of Warren Zevon's songs couldn't be played on AM or FM radio? Now, this is a journalistic use of the word, so don't blanch, Agnes, because they had the word shit in them.
Oh, I'm sorry, you can't say that on the air in America. You know we got free speech.
Yeah, definitely free speech on Wednesday, slow on the driveway. You know, every now and then, you know, we get into this little thing that we get into from time to time, and we say, well, gee, do you think they're really going to be able to form a theocracy in the United States? Is it going to be, are the Taliban Christians going to take over?
They already have!
If you live in a country where certain words, because they're deemed to be dirty, dirty words, can't be said, you're living, sunshine, in a theocracy. If you live somewhere where you can't buy anything stronger than cooking sherry, like the dry county that I grew up in Alabama, you're living, sunshine, in a theocracy. You know, one of the things that I've frequently said in relation to the 9/11 issue is that as long as we're staring backwards at 9/11, we guarantee 10/10, 11/11, 12/12, 1/1, 2/2, 3/3, whatever comes next. Because we're so busy looking backwards, we're not looking forwards. Well, it's kind of the same thing, only different, with this business of, you know, the right-wing religion industry fanatics going to control America. Well, we're waiting for them to take control, and they already have. They already have. You know, the from the beginning of this show, we nominated the drive-by truckers as the as our patron band, or our unwitting house band. I don't know how Patterson and Cooley and the bunch would feel about it, but they are. We love them. Guess why they can't get played on radio? Oh, they say the brown word. And they say that German derivative word that begins with F that describes the sex act. Have any of you or your children or grandchildren or you as children ever been harmed by a word? Now, I tend to draw out and exclude the stuff that is said to be deliberately hateful. The N-word and all its various and disgusting connotations. Words for people who happen to have been born Jewish. Words for people who happen to have been born Arabic. Words for people who happen to have been born Vietnamese, Thai, Cambodian, Laos, Chinese, Japanese. All the beautiful panoply of racism that just coats this country like a coat of many colors. Those words I exclude. But have you ever been hurt by hearing the brown word spoken? The F word spoken? The GD word? No, of course not. There are times when it's downright funny. There are other times when it's gratuitous and uncalled for. But do you realize we live in a nation where if the Washington Post... Wait, I was about to do a hypothetical. I don't have to do a hypothetical. How did the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, stop with the listing, Bob. How did they all respond when Dear Leader got caught in an open mic showing what a foul mouth? See, I'm being a hypocrite now. How did they respond when Dear Leader got caught behind an open microphone using those objectionable words? Well, you know, even journalism couldn't print those words. Wow, little six-year-old Johnny may be reading the story about Dear Leader today and he'll see the brown word. And the F word. And then we won't get to sing the national anthem no more. And you see, that is what this is. That is what this is about. Because, you know, like Crystal said, Werewolves of London was written in 15 minutes. And then, boom, the biggest hit Warren ever had. It was not the best song he ever did, not by a long shot. But, you see, radio in this country... Music radio only plays stuff that's been focus grouped and tested, and little minions sit there and say, "Did you like it when it ended this way, or did the minor chord bum you out when it ended on the minor chord, and did the character in the lyric need to die, or should the character in the lyric get married?" They do this. They focus group. The mainstream country music is notorious for this stuff. And it's, of course, it's in mainstream so-called rock and roll. And this is not me being a fuddy-duddy. But radio stations couldn't and wouldn't program Warren Zevon's music and that of so many, many others because, you know, it doesn't fit the demographic. And I guess it is kind of hard to segue out of Britney Spears and into Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. Isn't it? Yeah, probably. But that's not the artist's fault. You know, this is a country where artists wait tables and fit shoes on the feet of people, you know, doing the and do whatever jobs they can to get to keep on doing their art because this country doesn't value art. You know, that old Latin phrase that appears under the banner of MGM, right where the lion's roaring, ars gratia artis, art for the sake of art. We don't value it. We're happy for people to labor, although we do love the, and Warren Zevon recognized this, it's obvious in the book, There's a segment where when he finishes The Wind, his last album, he says something to the effect of, "Well, now I have to hurry up and die before the Grammys get passed." And sure enough, Warren died, and it was just a Grammy fest for that album. And it wasn't, they didn't do it because he died. I at least I hope not. They did it because it's a brilliant piece of work. So is Life Will Kill You. So is My Rides Here. So is The Envoy. But the fact of the matter is that as far you go as far back as one of my heroes, Mark Twain, and he writes a story where a bunch of starving artists put together a conspiracy to create the myth of this dying painter, and they start leeching little paintings. This is, takes place in France, but they leech little paintings out into the marketplace, and oh, he's sick, he's very sick, and the painting values just go up, 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 up. Meanwhile, back in the little studio apartment, they're painting for all they're worth, trying to create a body of work for this dying genius painter. And you know these, and you know that's fiction. The story of John Kennedy Toole, author of A Confederacy of Dunces, is not fiction. The man had a comic sense, the likes of which we haven't seen since Mark Twain. He authored A Confederacy of Dunces, shopped it. Ah, this is unpublishable. Ah, you know, no thanks. Yeah, this isn't what the market wants right now. He finally got disgusted with it, went home and blew his stinking brains out because he'd poured his soul into his art. And everybody went... Once he was a dead author with a tragic story, however, it became a national bestseller. Happens all the time. And we kind of like it that way. Not you, not me, not us. But our incredibly shallow culture that pulls its self-meaning out of its ability to sit back and go, "Well, it ain't me. Sunshine is going to be you someday." Right? Yeah. Let's go to the phones. David joins us from Maine. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. So what happens to be the topic of the day?
Well, we've been working through Crystal Zevon's book, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon, the biography that just came out yesterday. And, you know, I mean, you've probably heard on hold there a little bit, just the general plight of art, artists, and culture in this country.
Well, you know, going to that, I guess you know the news of Joan Baez.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Joan Baez cannot. She's not American enough to sing for injured soldiers at Walter Reed.
She can't sing because of the fact of her anti-folk background. And now the Army and the military is saying, no, that's not it. There was a thing in her contract, and that's why she can't sing.
Yeah, never mind the fact that John Mellencamp invited her to join him, and they handled all the paperwork. They did it all. And the people at Walter Reed say, well, you know, no, we didn't have time, and that would force us to have to file form number XYZ17201/I-R, which we'd have to file in quintuple at 18 times. And, you know, they're simply in, and we haven't budgeted for that in the Iraq War resolution, and the Democrats hate the troops, and they won't let the, yeah.
Even John Mellencamp said, when he asked, they said, she doesn't fit in here, period. So there's your answer. She doesn't fit in here.
What does fit in there? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying. I know Mellencamp doesn't have the credibility of, say, Springsteen, or something like that when it comes to anti-war. But he's had his moments of protest.
Mellencamp lacking credibility? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, he's had his moments where he's made comments, social commentary. Just, I think maybe not as strong as Joan Baez, but still. I mean, who's measuring this? Who's weighing this?
Well, I know.
And that's what it comes down to. I don't think anyone's weighing it. I think it's all just strict. It's one of the most paranoid administrations. It's got the military paranoid now. And you see what they did with the blogs now, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I've got that on the list for tonight.
Oh, you got that on the list?
Yeah.
And then, oh, speaking of censorship, someone cracked the code for the HD DVD key. I don't know if you heard about this.
No.
For Linux. So you could play it on Linux. And what happened is a lot of...
Okay, back up. I think you've just run about 6 light years ahead of me. Crack the code for which?
HD DVD encryption key.
Oh, okay.
So they could just play it on the Linux operating system.
Oh.
And it wasn't a big deal because they're going to change the code anyway. But what happened is people said, well, you can't... I mean, this deals with censorship again. I guess the whole theme tonight is really just censorship, if you think about it.
Yeah, it is. And we live in a country, David, where... we've decided that there are benign forms of censorship and there are non-benign forms.
Right, and it's you know, it's a theme of filtering, and it's a theme of diluting what you think is right. Like looking at the water, say, is this water clear enough? Is this water clear enough, Jake? Is this water clear enough? Is this water clear enough, Mary? No, it's not clear enough.
No.
And so what they tried to do was, I don't know what the DMC, what the Digital Rights Copyright team is thinking, but what they try to do is they try to censor. That's going to work. Censor the internet. Don't say the code. So they got a lot of lawyers to email all these blogs yesterday. They were frantic over it. Like, you can't put the code out there. That's an illegal violation. So what ended up happening was they exploded. I mean, if you put the code, I'll send you the code. And you could put it in the Google search and see where it is. It's everywhere. It's on eBay.
Well, that's throwing the tide back from the sea a bucket at a time.
I know. It's on YouTube. YouTube has a
song. And David, that's the dynamic that's involved here, and it
right.
is a dynamic tension. Authors have rights. Creators have rights. And they've got the right to the benefit of their labor. One of the lifelong travails of Mark Twain was the fact that he would no sooner get a book written and get the manuscript in the galleys to his publisher than what would happen in that day and age is copyright violators and pirates would have moles placed inside the company, and Twain would find that one of his new books had been published in Canada and England before it came out in the United States in the authorized edition.
Well, I think the issue here mostly is the fact that when you say you can't put this up, and the fact that they think they own ownership over some numbers, that someone found in the system. I think that's the bigger issue, and like I said, it doesn't really matter because they're going to change it anyway. The encryption key, it has to. The bigger issue is the same thing of like I'm trying to think of another example where this happened, but it really has to do with the fact that if they were quiet on that issue, more and more companies and more people would have like Dig.com, they put themselves on the line for something like that. It doesn't have to do with the issue of hacking or anything like that. It's more so the fact when someone says you can't do this, you can't. That's even more reason to speak out and just put whatever it is that people are telling you you can't put up. Put it on buttons. Put it on everything. That's the whole main thing about it. Because like I said, they're changing it now as we speak. So.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the nature of the process is that it's the dynamic tension between the lock pick and the lock and the lock maker. It's the build a better mousetrap kind of thing.
Well, the reason why that happens so often is because these companies have such contempt, and they're so they're so petty when it comes to any hackers who test their material and say, oh yeah, this can't be hacked.
Well, do you remember this goes back to the electronic voting machine debate,
right?
Especially with the DREs. Oh no, you can't. And it was written into the daggum legislation in states all over this country, David, that the individual states could not examine the source code for the machine. Oh, that's proprietary information. And they screamed like the D-Bolds and the ES and S's and the Sequoias and so forth, screamed like stuck pigs.
It's the issue of controlling and filtering. It even goes to our side. Like, you heard what happened with the Obama's camp today, right?
No, what?
Obama had somebody working on their MySpace page, and this guy started like close to 2 years ago, and he's a paralegal from Washington, D.C. What happened is the consultant saw the page, and they saw that he had 160,000 friends. I think you know where I'm going with this now. And like, oh, that's great. That's great. You got 160,000 friends? Wow, how'd you do that? And then they got on the team. They said, okay, all right, we'll help you with the page. And all of a sudden, he found himself, you know, frantically working hour after hour. I think this is going to make you a little pee, Bob. Hour after hour after hour, and they were like, well, and so eventually he was asking, well, I'm doing all this work and you guys aren't paying me? He's like, I don't know if that's really fair. And he's like, no, don't. He goes, you want to help somebody win a democracy back, right? And then what happened is that eventually they locked the guy out of his own. I mean, this is surreal world now.
Yeah.
They locked him out and he said, well, if you guys do that, I'm taking my friends with me, which aren't real friends, but I think you know what I mean. It's all perception. So he took almost like 80 or 90% of his friends list with him, and then he left a post on, this was on CNN, by the way, about 2 hours ago, and he left a post up, and he said, you know, after dealing with this and just wanting to get a little compensation after working more than 12 hours a day on this site, because I've lost my energy to even want to vote for Obama. And I think that's more revealing. These consultants, these losers, they couldn't even pay this guy money.
Well, no, because, and you just, oh boy, have you opened up a door here.
Oh,
David.
I know.
Because, see, first of all, new media is something that people who walk around with peanut butter sandwiches in their back pocket and play hacky sack all the time do, okay? It's not real media. It's new media, and it should be for free. Because, you know, what were the fundraising numbers? $24-25 million that Hillary and Obama raised in a quarter?
Right.
Good for them. But, yeah, you know, who's going to get that money? Well, the first person's going to get that money is the consultant.
Mm.
Okay, the consultant, you know, and he consults and he advises the candidate as to where best to make his media buys. And, you know, don't say Iraq war, say Iraq conflict. And don't wear the blue suit with the red stripe.
Right.
Wear the gray suit with the blue stripe.
That's what they started doing to that guy, they said.
And it's a multi-million.
That's what he is, because it's an American institution. You know, being a first-generation West Indian American, you know, like I've told people, I've been called the N-word more times by my so-called own than any white person. And that's a sad fact.
See, that I see it as a fighting word. I do.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes you do. I see, you know, and unfortunately, me, if it's come to the point where I feel more uncomfortable when a black person refers to me as that, because, you know, to me it's just self-hatred and self-loathing, than when a white person calls me that.
For
the most part, I would say 90% of the sane white people will never call me that. Or they may think it, but they won't call me that. So when a black person does it, it stings a lot more. So, you know, to me, and matter of fact, it's been, when a white person does it, that means to a certain degree for me personally that he fears me. For some reason or another, he fears me, or he's uncomfortable with my presence or what have you. But, you know, there's money to be made in the use of that word. And as long as there's money to be made, it will be encouraged in America.
But I feel like I have some level of responsibility, Kevin. I can't give marching orders, and I'm not going to sit here and be like that the revolting freak John Gibson and complain about or give orders to or make suggestions to how the black community deals with that word, because frankly, I feel like that word should be given over to the black community, and they should be able to take it out and fold it, spindle it, mutilate it, bury it at midnight, say a black mass over it, whatever, okay? But when it comes to the institutionalization of the word by virtue of the confirmation of a man who approves of its usage, and that man is a white man, and that man is ascending to the second highest court in the United States, then I have a moral responsibility to decry it.
And but you know, I kind of look at it as that racism has done very well for America. And as long as people are doing well off of racism and exploitation and every other shun or ism there is, people are going to partake in it.
For almost the first 100 years of this nation's existence, Kevin, this nation's prosperity was advanced by people who were deemed to be 3/5, 4/5 of a human being.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're right. Racism has been very good to America.
Yeah.
And you could make the same argument that apartheid was very, very good for South Africa.
Exactly, and you know, and in some aspects, apartheid in South Africa hasn't ended. Yes, there are blacks in political power, but still, who owns all the wealth in South Africa?
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know, try and find any. How many black people are sitting on the boards of De Beers or Kloof Gold Mining Company?
You know, I'm just guessing, but I'd bet zero.
Exactly, if not. You know, and if they are, you know, they're probably like a Clarence Thomas type who are so, you know, anti-black. You know, so I like I said, the N-word has been, and racism has been very good to America, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. So I've come to the point where, you know, these are things I have to make peace with while I'm still living in this country. You know.
But, Kevin, can you make peace with it? Can you just say, oh, well, that's America?
I have no choice. Because, if I don't, then, you know, until America's willing, and express it, you know, until America's willing to finally grow up, you have no choice.
See, I don't necessarily remember because I was a child, but I am at least cognizant of a day when we might perhaps have hoped instead that hundreds of people would gather outside that hateful, venomous man's house every morning, every night, 24 hours a day, screaming, resign, 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 until he was, as he deservedly should be, hounded from the bench.
But that was between the age of when, you know, 1969 to 1980. Those days are long gone, because once Reagan came in, and, you know, it was like, be as bad as you want to be politics.
And the Gulf is, yeah, the Gulf is widening, Kevin, because after all, and I think I've mentioned it at least once before on this program, the Isaiah Thomas story and the Isaiah Thomas lawsuit, you know, against the New York Knicks, where he testified under oath that, well, you know, if a white man calls a woman a bitch, that's really bad. But it's not the same thing if a black man calls a woman a bitch. It has a different meaning. So, you know, let's make no mistake. The Gulf is wide, but it's widening on both sides of the on both sides of the sea. You know what I'm saying? But in this instance, when people who are lily white start tolerating it, when Dianne Feinstein is willing to tolerate it, when an old Klansman like Byrd is willing to tolerate it, when Ben Nelson of Nebraska is willing to tolerate it, when Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut is willing to tolerate it, I have a moral obligation not to remain silent.
And you know what? And I commend you for that. But again, you know, it all boils down to these people have become very powerful or have made very good livings off of hatred and off of, you know, certain words like the N-word or the K-word or whatever. And, you know, they've put it to this way. In short, they've been able to lead very comfortable lives off of the exploitation of fellow human beings. And, you know, it's not going to change anytime soon. And, you know, you just have to, I've reached the stage now where I have to make peace with whatever, you know, hand that I've been dealt with. Because if not, I'm either going to do one or two things, bang my head against the wall, drink myself to death, or, you know, or just end up in a straitjacket.
Or drink yourself to death and bang your head into a wall. That happens too.
Yeah. You know, it's just, you have to. And, you know, this is not a black thing, a white thing, or a brown thing. It's an American thing. When you have Mexican Americans, you know, basically spying on their own cousins at the border, or their poor cousins at the border, and deporting them and going through God knows what kind of humiliation that they got to go through, it's an American thing. They bit into their American BS dream.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, they're not crossing the border. The border was moved on them.
Sure. Well, this idea, one of the ones that I love the best is when some right-wing freak in California will introduce a bill making English the official language of California.
Yeah.
The official language was some Native American tongue at one point in time.
But it was
Spanish long before it was English.
That too, but you know what? The founding fathers, like you and I believe they were very intelligent people, and there was no official language. Because if that's the case, you know, someone like Newt Gingrich, whose family came from Germany, you know, 100 years ago, you know, there were more German Americans speaking. There was more German spoken in this country than there was English. It was because of two world wars, a lot of German Americans to prove their loyalty to this country.
Oh yeah, and one of the reasons for the tremendous civil liberties crackdown in the First World War was because there was a feeling, not as pronounced as when we interned the Japanese in World War II, but a feeling that the loyalty of German Americans who had been here for a generation or two was somehow suspect, and it happened all over the Upper Midwest. So,
and even in Brooklyn, where I come from, you know, they're still built beer halls. And, you know, the neighborhood that our friend Joe grew up in, Bushwick, was a German neighborhood. And he can tell you, there are huge ruined beer halls in Brooklyn. They're in condos now, expensive ones. But, you know, those were old beer halls of German, and the German-American Bund was very active in Brooklyn. And, you know, a lot of Germans just gave up household in order to prove how loyal of Americans they were during the two world wars. So, you know, it's almost hypocrisy to me when I see someone like Newt Gingrich or whoever else they, you know, English has to be the official language of this country. Language is something that changes every 10 miles, like Mahatma Gandhi said. Hello?
Yeah, well, I'm right here. I'm soaking it all in because no, you're speaking so much truth, Kevin. And I don't know that it should be refuted or commented on. It's sad. I mean, how can I put this? I had to run downtown today. I'm about to downtown. You know, town isn't much around here, Kevin. But I stopped at the Veterans Memorial because I wanted to see there are bricks in the pavement that have the name of every person who has served in every armed conflict in this particular district of the county. And I looked for my uncle's names. I looked for my father's name. I looked for my great uncle's name. I saw the names there that I had heard about growing up. And there has been so much given for so much that is right about this place. And yet, despite all of that rightness, you know, one bad apple does spoil the barrel.
Oh, yeah.
And it would seem that after all that sacrifice, the people who didn't have to make those sacrifices would be at least marginally willing to make the affirmative steps necessary to see the dream go forward. But we're not going forward, Kevin. We're going backwards.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're absolutely right. You know, I think it was Stephanie Miller who read the 10 Steps to Fascism a couple of days ago. And it makes Americans comfortable. No, we are living in a fascist society. We have been for the past nearly 30 years.
True enough. Well, from Nixon forward, I mean, that's really the beginning of it all. Just heard from somebody I haven't heard from in a long time regarding Feinstein, who let that rat bastard Southwick out of the committee. And she says, I imagine you're screaming about Feinstein. It's definitely good insurance. And I assume she means for Feinstein. It's definitely good insurance against anthrax letters and terrified plane trips. Kevin, this is a matter of paranoia. Unmitigated, probably medicatable paranoia on my part. That I see things like this, and I wonder who got to whom with what. Because that is the kind of ham-fisted thuggery that the opposite party engages in. What was done to Dianne Feinstein to make her make that decision?
Well, I don't know, but I'm with you on that one, because even the guy who was basically threatened to lose all his committee memberships yesterday, what did they come down on him with? You know, what did they come up? What dirty laundry he has made him say he's...
I know. I'm looking at another email here, Kevin. Someone taking issue with you. She says you should have passion for right and wrong, and that word is awful. Everything about it is awful, and black people should not use it either, money or not. Our humanity should not be traded for profit, and that is what this younger generation, the post-Reagan generation, doesn't understand. They just want their piece of the pie, and they think they can sell anything to have it. Oh, darn it, Kevin. Sometimes Kevin has cell phone troubles. I bet that's him again. Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin. My call was dropped. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you moved.
Yeah.
But anyway, she says, I don't know, she's encouraging you to not be willing to live with it, or not just say that that's how it is, but to openly oppose it.
Yeah, well, believe you me, I understand what she's saying, but there are times it's just hard. It's hard work, and, you know, I'm tired. I really am tired. You know, all I want to do, Bob, just like a majority, is just live your life. But there are times, just live your life, be with your family, you know, enjoy your children, see them grow up, and just get through life. And it's definitely difficult. It really is difficult. And, you know, you cannot change. It's the most difficult thing to do is change the hearts and minds of people.
But that,
really,
but that's the thing, Kevin. We thought we were on the way to it. We thought, you know, nothing happens overnight, and sometimes generations have to die off. Okay,
yeah.
But Leslie Southwick is not some the 90-year-old creamed corn chewing old Strom Thurmond wannabe. He's not that much older than me. Okay, maybe he's a decade older than me.
Well,
we should have made some progress on the Leslie Southwick somewhere along the way, but obviously we haven't.
Well, the thing is, you know, come on. You know, I've lived in the South. You're a man of the South. There are people who are still talking about Sherman's ride through Georgia 150 years after the fact.
Yeah, well, oh, God.
You know, I living in northern Florida, I've heard people talk about it as if it happened like 5 years ago.
I hate having my own personal mythology about what America is and should be assaulted so viscerally and so shamelessly.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. This is just, you know, hey, you, all of you who believe that we could achieve a level of that the words in the Constitution actually mean something. You know, that's what we got today.
You open up the door to your house and you look at it and go, holy smoke, house is on fire. Especially if you're a parent. Because down the hallway are your kids, the pride of your life. And you try and make your way down the hallway, but you can't because the heat and the smoke has driven you down. So now you have to retreat back to your room choking. You get on the phone, dial 911. Yes, ma'am, what's the nature of your emergency? House is on fire. Burning down. Kids are trapped. Yes, ma'am, they'll be there in a minute. Minute, hell, seconds. Seconds matter. Get here now. You want the fire department now. And they show up. You want them showing up in horse-drawn buggies? Get up. No. You want them showing up in dilapidated 30-year-old fire engines? No. You want them screaming up the hill in the most modern fire engine taxpayer money can buy. And when they show up and hit the fire hydrant, do you want a water supply that works or doesn't work? You want it to work first time out. Feed the water to the engine. You want firefighters who are well-trained or guys who are bumbling all over themselves? Well-trained firefighters with equipment that can withstand the heat so they can smash the window, go in and grab your kids and get them out now. We love our firefighters, but we hate fire. We hate fire. We despise fire. We recognize fire is a destructive force to society. If fire was such a good thing, we'd be handing out medals to arsonists. Think about it. Thank you for burning down my building and giving my firefighters a chance to do their thing. Here's a medal. No, we arrest them, we put them in jail. As we should. What? It's October. What's big in October? Fire Prevention Month, is it not? Don't you have firefighters going to all your schools telling the kids to drop, enroll? Yes, fire prevention is a good thing for a society. But we still love our firefighters. We don't hate our firefighters. We hate fire, and we practice fire prevention. Ladies and gentlemen, it's high time our society became a society of war preventionists. We don't hate our troops. We love our troops. They're the best thing in the world for us. They honor us by wearing our uniform. And if they ever have to go to war, God forbid, we want them to have the best equipment possible. We want to have the best training possible and the best leadership possible so that if they are called upon to fight, they will prevail. But we will not glorify war. We will condemn war. We despise war, and we must collectively work to prevent war. Because if we don't become war preventionists, then we will fall to the addiction of war. And we know what the addiction of war is. We see it day after day. Turn on the television. Go to the movie theater. War is entertainment. War is cool. War is heroic. And we fall to the narcotic of conflict. And we fall victim to it. Especially because we are privileged to live in a society where so few Americans truly know war. And then by falling victim to the narcotic of war, we then fall victim to the drug dealers of war, the military-industrial complex. And we allow them to leech their way into our daily life, dominating what we see on TV, dominating what we see at the theater, dominating how our nation conducts its business at home and abroad. Try going to Paducah, Kentucky and having this conversation. It's going to be very difficult because they got a depleted uranium plant that's making a lot of money right now crunching out munitions for the military. Try going to Olympia, Washington and having this discussion. It's very difficult because the dock workers who were unemployed for a number of years are now working full-time pumping military goods out their port. When you have a society that has such a significant portion of its gross national product dedicated to the business of war, don't be surprised when the product your country exports more efficiently than anything else becomes war. We are a nation addicted to war. We have to break that addiction, ladies and gentlemen, because if we don't, we will find that we are pre-programmed to become a fascist state. And if we are to survive as a nation worthy of the title the United States of America, we must become the anti-fascists. That's what we used to be. But if you reflect on what we have become as a society today, the way that the military-industrial complex dominates us economically, dominates us politically, dominates us as a society. What are the symbols of America today? Think about it. Used to be, you know, baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. Used to be a little ditty in the TV that I don't have a good voice or I'd sing it for you. But that's not it. We got an American flag, but that American flag's got to be wrapped around a B-1 bomber, an M-1 tank, an F-15 fighter, a Marine, a soldier, a sailor, an airman. These are the symbols of America, especially when we talk about how the world views us. It's not the Peace Corps the world's looking at anymore. It's the Marine Corps. And the Marine Corps doesn't stand for the forces of freedom coming ashore to liberate. The Marine Corps, tragically, has become a symbol of oppression, just like the American Army has become a symbol of oppression. The Navy, the Air Force. You can say, well, wait a minute, Ritter, you're treading on tough ground here. I'll tell you what. Take your passport and join me as we go around the world and talk to the people around the world about how they view America. Don't sit here and tell me from the comfort of your home in West Virginia or in New York or anywhere else in America what the rest of the world thinks about us. Get out. Get out and about and see it as I have. And I've been watching the world change its opinion of the United States for a number of years. America has always been a bull in a china shop. That's okay. You can sort of forgive a bull. A well-meaning bull in a china shop is still going to break some things. Doesn't mean to, just a little too big for the china shop. And since World War II, we've been a young bull out there in the world, moving around, breaking some china, but we've been trying to do the right thing. But the world doesn't see that anymore. The turning point came in 1992 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. See, from World War II, the end of World War II, up until 1992, we were pretty much engaged in a global conflict of good versus evil. That's a gross oversimplification, but that's how it was sold to us. America, the leader of global democracy, versus the Soviet Union and Communist China, the leader of global tyranny and oppression. And we fought this Cold War to oppose tyranny and oppression. And we won. It's amazing. Had hardly a shot being fired. One day you wake up, Soviet Union's gone. Warsaw Pact is gone. The enemy is gone. Then how did we behave? There's a debate ongoing in Washington, D.C. at that time, what the direction of American foreign policy should be. Should we work with the world to develop a multilateral approach to problem solving? Breathe relevance back into the United Nations, which had simply become a playground for superpowers to banter about. Do we now make the United Nations relevant? Or do we step into the vacuum created by the demise of the Soviet Union and fill the vacuum with American power, thereby ensuring that no nation or group of nation ever rises up to confront us again the way the Soviet Union did? The path we chose was to fill the vacuum with American power. Now, it wasn't a path that we jumped right into. In 1992, that time, Secretary of State, or Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, and he had two of his subordinates, a gentleman named Paul Wolfowitz and a gentleman named Scooter Libby, they drafted a Defense Department vision statement. And basically it said that America will divide the world into spheres of national security interests, and we will impose our will on these spheres using our superiority in diplomatic, economic, and military might. Well, the good news was this was a draft, and it got leaked to the New York Times, and you had the United States Senate read it, and they said some amazing things when they reflected on this. They said this policy is inherently un-American, that this is not how America should interface with the world, that this is a document of empire, not of global citizenry. And it was rejected. It was sent back to the drafting shop to be worked on. But unfortunately for the drafters, their president, George Herbert Walker Bush, got voted out of office in the fall of 1992. He was replaced by Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton did not believe in this concept of global domination. And so for 8 years, Clinton governed. Not perfectly, by the way. I'm a harsh critic of Bill Clinton. But he governed in a manner that deviated from global domination. So the framers of this policy of global domination, they left government and they went off to think tanks. Hudson Institute, American Enterprise Institute, the Washington Center for Near East Policy, where they festered. And I use that term on purpose. They festered. They became open wounds that filled with pus. And the product of this infection emerged in 1996 when all these ideologues came together in an organization called the Project for a New American Century. And they put forward a vision statement. The vision statement was virtually a word-for-word replication of the 1992 Defense Department draft mission statement. Now you'd say, well, what do we have to fear, Ritter? These are just American citizens doing what they're allowed to do. They're not government. They're just expressing their freedom to say how they want to operate. Fine. That's fine. They're not government. But they imposed their will on government. In 1998, they were powerful enough to get Bill Clinton to sign what's called the Iraq Liberation Act, which said it is the policy of the United States to remove Saddam Hussein from power. For all of you who think that what's going on in Iraq right now is George W. Bush's war and soul mind, think again. This is a war that must be called Bill Clinton's war, because it started with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton invented the policy of lying about weapons of mass destruction. Bill Clinton invented the policy of using UN weapons inspectors to spy on Saddam Hussein in a violation of the charter or in violation of the mandate set forth by the Security Council. And Bill Clinton is the one who bought into the policy of regime change being the policy of the United States in regards to Saddam Hussein. This policy was inherited by George W. Bush, who said he will perfect this policy. And he has. And that's what we got today, perfection in Iraq, courtesy of Texas. But no, they didn't make policy. They weren't in the government until the 2000 election. Now, I participated in the 2000 election. I'm one of those silly 38% of the American public that actually goes out and votes. And I voted for George W. Bush in that election. I couldn't vote for Al Gore. He spent 8 years lying to me as a weapons inspector. The Clinton administration was lower than dirt, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to foreign policy. One lie after another lie after another lie. So I said, I'll give this guy from Texas a chance. And you know, when I voted for him, he spoke about being a uniter, not a divider. He spoke in simple terms that even a former Marine like myself could understand. And I bought into it. I said, all right, I'm with you, George. And suddenly he gets elected, and you start looking at the people he starts populating his government with. When he ran for office, he did not have the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party running alongside him. Remember, he was a uniter, not a divider. He was going to work with the Democrats. Suddenly we have the far right dominating the system of governance. It was a virtual coup d'etat because the American people didn't vote for this. And this was that festering pus from the think tanks that produced not only the Project for a New American Century vision statement, but now brought this in to the government and made it official policy of the land. September 2002, the Bush administration published its National Security Strategy of the United States of America. Again, it's a virtual word-for-word replication of the 1992 Defense Department vision statement and the Project for a New American Century vision statement. What did it say? It said, America will divide the world into spheres of strategic national interest, and we will impose our will using military, economic, and political means, regardless of international law. I always love that one, regardless of international law. You know, a lot of Americans give short shrift to international law. We're Americans. I don't want no foreigner telling me what to do. Well, you know, when you give short shrift to international law, you hear it all the time. The UN, a bunch of bumbling foreigners with blue hats, they can't do anything right. They're incompetent. Well, they may be. It's a club, by the way. Club of nation states, and there's rules and regulations. We call this the Charter of the United Nations. And like any club, it can only work if every member agrees to abide by the same set of rules. But when you got a handful of members that say, no, we get to have our own rules, don't be surprised when the club doesn't work. And when you have the United States of America saying that unilateral American policy trumps the United Nations Charter, don't be surprised when the UN doesn't work. Now, if that doesn't shock you that the United States would operate in a manner which is in violation of the United Nations Charter, it should. You see, they come back to that Constitution we all should be reading. Article 6, Supremacy Clause. When America has entered into a treaty or international agreement and ratified by 2/3 of the United States Senate, it becomes the supreme law of the land. We are signatories to the United Nations Charter. Therefore, we are beholden to the rule of law set forth by the United Nations Charter. And when it comes to issues such as war, the Charter is quite clear. There's two conditions and two conditions alone in which this nation can go to war. Article 51, if we have been invaded, we have a right to legitimate self-defense. And then there's Chapter 7 that says that the Security Council of the United Nations finds that a situation has emerged that threatens collective peace and security, it can authorize member states to use military force to resolve this problem. When we went to war against Iraq in 2003, we didn't have a Security Council resolution authorizing the use of force. Iraq had not attacked us. We had not gone to the Security Council and sought to invoke Article 51. We went to war because we're America, and we said we could go to war. Now, I don't know what an accepted definition of empire is, but I will tell you that when you go through and study history, empires are those nations that seek to impose their will on others, usually through the use of force. So, most Americans would reject the notion that we're the new Rome, that we are a global empire, that we seek to be a force of global dominance. So, no, we're Americans. We're peace-loving folk. We want to live in harmony with people. We don't want to dominate. No. The policies of the United States of America as currently in place not only permit us to dominate through the use of force, they say it is the preferred option. The new National Security Strategy of the United States of America, promulgated in March of 2006, not only continues the policies put out in 2004, but you'd have thought, here we are 4 years or 3 years after the invasion of Iraq, that we'd gotten our act together somehow. We'd realize that maybe going into Iraq preemptively was wrong. But no. It says that preemptive military action is the preferred policy. That's what we do. Now, that's shocking. Because, again, it not only says that we'll violate the Constitution, because that's what's happening here, ladies and gentlemen. It's an outright violation of the Constitution. And if you call yourself an American, then you must be defending the Constitution, and you should be shocked that our nation would behave in this way. That's okay. Maybe you aren't there. You know what else you should be reading, though, besides the Constitution? Reflect on that word, preemptive war. Go back to 1946. The Nuremberg Tribunal. It took place after we defeated the forces of fascism. Judge Henry Jackson of the Supreme Court ruled over this tribunal, and he determined that a war of aggression, and indeed the act of planning and implementing a war of aggression, was the supreme war crime. Does she need some water? Okay. Supreme war crime. And he condemned Germans to death for committing this act. The supreme war crime. Now we have a policy of the United States of America that endorses preemptive war. Ladies and gentlemen, we are sliding down a slippery slope that must be reversed. Fascism and empire. Two terms that should not be used in the same breath as the United States of America, unless you're talking about how America opposes fascism and opposes global empire. But the sad reality is that today, the single most powerful nation on the face of the earth stands closer to fitting the definition of a fascist state than it does fitting the definition of a representative democracy. And that when we speak of how we interface with the rest of the world, I defer to 6.8 billion people who say that America is a nation seeking global domination and global empire. And indeed, the national security strategy of the United States speaks of not only regional, but global hegemony. But that's okay, they say. America is a nation that is just and will rule properly. And I'm sure the Romans thought that Caesar was just and would rule properly. But ask any nation subjected to the rule of Rome what they would prefer, the tyranny of the legion or their freedom. And they would choose freedom every time. And we should know that, because we rejected the tyranny of empire when we gave birth to this nation. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to collectively decide what we stand for, who we are, and what we are. This is a difficult topic to bring up sometimes, because it forces us to reflect not only on the failings of government. Heck, we do that all the time. It's easy to blame government. We have to blame more than government. We have to blame ourselves. We have to look in the mirror and say, have I been the best citizen possible? Are we a nation of citizens today? I don't know. After 9/11, and I say this as a New Yorker who lost friends, firefighters, in the World Trade Center, so I don't treat the events of 9/11 lightly. But after 9/11, what did the president appeal to when he tried to get the nation to rally? Did he say, ladies and gentlemen, I need volunteers to line up. We're going to pay higher taxes. I need people to go in the military. We're going to go out and bring these people to justice. Or did he say, go shopping? He said, go shopping. What's this mean? Are we a nation of citizens or a nation of consumers? And I think on reflection, we're going to have to acknowledge that we are prisoners to consumerism, that we have wrapped ourselves in a cocoon of comfort. A cocoon of comfort. And so long as the government keeps us waddling down a path of relative prosperity, we will not rock the boat. A citizen will shed the cocoon of comfort, not forswear an oath of poverty. I consider myself a good citizen, but I'll tell you right now, my wife and my daughters will not allow me to take an oath of poverty. I got to give them their stuff. You know, they need their things. No. America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, is also a land where we can have a good lifestyle. And we're going to defend that lifestyle. But if we reflect on this lifestyle, what are we saying? If you think about it for a second, we're a small percentage of the world's population. And yet we use a quarter to a third of the world's natural resources to feed our addiction to a lifestyle that we simply can't live without. What this means, therefore, is that we cannot sustain this lifestyle using the resources inherent within our own borders. That we have to go out and get resources that belong to other people, which is okay if you're willing to pay a fair market price. But we're not, because in order to pay a fair market price means we've got to jack the price up here at home. And then the consumer is unhappy. Got to keep the consumer happy. And so we buy into the notion of cell phones for everybody. Do you know what's in your cell phone? The compound that's there, where they get it from? They get it from Zaire, from the Congo. And it's mined by slaves. And there's wars fought over this material. If you knew for a second how many people had to die so each one of us could have our Motorola Razr, you might be a little bit more hesitant in going out and purchasing it. But no, we, the consumer, don't want to think about these realities. We just want our cell phone, and we want it now. It better have all the little gadgets we want on the cell phone to make it work. Consumers, ladies and gentlemen, that's what we've become. A consumer sits back and lets the government hand-feed us on the things that make us happy. A consumer shops. A citizen invests his or herself into their country. A citizen says, this land is mine. This town is mine. This state is mine. This country is mine. It belongs to me, and I will defend it and everything it stands for, to the point of actually breaking free of the cocoon of comfort and going out and making it a little less convenient for your daily life. Not a vow of poverty, but a promise of service to the nation. But that's not how we operate. That's not who we are. A key aspect of good being a good citizen is empowering yourself with knowledge and information. People say, well, I watch the news. I read the newspapers. Look, I was an intelligence officer. And I'll tell you right now, the intelligence cycle is pretty simple. The very first thing that has to occur to have intelligence, though, is direction. Somebody has to say, this is the question I want answered. That's the direction. Then we spies go out and answer it by collecting information. Step two, collection. Then we take that information and we process it. Because just raw data means nothing. You've got to organize it, make it mean something, collate it chronologically, etc. And then you have to assess it, analyze it. What does this mean? Answer the question. And then you go to the final step, which is disseminate, which means take it back to the person who asked the question to begin with and answer the question. So if I ask the question, for instance, a good one to ask, is there weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? That'd be a nice one to get an answer to before you go to war over weapons of mass destruction, would it not? But that didn't happen. What happened instead is the director, or to paraphrase George W. Bush, the directorer, if he's a deciderer, he has to be a directorer. And I say this as a Republican, so I'm not up here grinding a political axe. He didn't ask the question, are there WMDs? He said, prove to me, or tell me again that there's WMDs. I know there's WMDs. Just give me the data that reinforces what I've already come to believe. And so they go out and collect data, but they don't subject it to all that other stuff. They just collect data, raw data that says, yes, there's WMDs, and feed it right back as if that answers the question. That's not intelligence. Now you think, well, okay, but we're Americans. We don't have access to the CIA. We get our information from the newspaper. I don't know. Do you? Did you sit in at the editorial meeting the night before and ask the question, what's going to be on the front page? Did you sit in at the editorial meeting and say, well, what story is going to lead off the 6 o'clock news? Or did somebody else make that decision for you? So you're not part of the intelligence cycle. You didn't ask the question. Did you collect the data yourself? Nope. Did you process it? Did you assess it? Did you answer your own question? Or are you prisoners to a news cycle that somebody else is preparing for you? You know, I hear all the time people saying, the media is to blame. The media is to blame. I don't know. You know what that reminds me of? You see it every spring. Little nest outside your front yard, full of little eggs, and they hatch, and the little baby sparrows come out, and they sit there and they go, feed me, feed me, feed me. And mama bird flies off and gets the worm, chews it up, puts it in her gullet, flies back, and pukes down the baby bird's throat, feeding the baby. That's what you guys are when you turn to the newspaper and the TV for information. Feed me, feed me. And the editors chew up the worm and puke it down your throat, and you're happy, you're satisfied. But you haven't empowered yourself. Somebody else is doing the thinking for you. Don't blame the media. Blame yourself. Being a citizen is hard work. It requires a dedication and a focus. There's plenty of access to raw data out there. Wake up in the morning and ask yourself the question, what do I want to know today? What's really going on in Iraq? What's really going on in Iraq? Does Iran have a nuclear weapons program? There's a heck of a question to ask. Then go out and collect the data. Not just what other people are saying, but go to the IAEA reports, the weapons inspectors that are in the country, so you can get it on the internet. Read the reports. Collect the data. Organize it. Assess it. Answer your question. You know what you've just become? A politician's worst nightmare. An informed citizen who can actually ask an in-depth question based upon some semblance of understanding of the problem at hand. We don't have an informed citizenry today. For a nation of 300 million people that claim to be the most technologically advanced nation in the world, we are some of the most ignorant people in the world today about the world we actually live in, ladies and gentlemen. And we're not going to resolve this problem of our slide towards fascism or our desire to imprint American empire abroad until we awaken ourselves. And that's the last challenge I give to you. Awaken yourself. Empower yourself with knowledge and information. Initiate this response to this challenge by reading the Constitution, establishing a core value of who you are and what you are. And then from that, become your own intelligence officer. Ask your own questions. Empower yourself with knowledge and information. And then start holding your elected representatives accountable for what they do in your name. West Virginia is blessed by having a senator who I disagree with on almost every topic except when he pulls out that Constitution. And when Senator Robert Byrd pulls out that Constitution, he becomes, in my mind, the greatest American serving us today. We should populate the halls of the Senate and the halls of Congress with people so inclined. But we can't begin to elect those who will defend the Constitution unless we're willing to stand up and defend it ourselves. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you. I'll take any questions you have.
Folks, if you'll pass your questions forward, we will we'll process them up here because we're getting a stream tape back there. So we're going to just pass them in, and we'll read them as they come in, and Scott will answer them.
Are the Hornet, is it Yellow Jackets? Are they doing well? No, how's the football team doing? No? No comment? Don't talk to me about baseball. I'm from New York. The Yankees didn't do well, so I'm unhappy. Did they? All right.
During the lull, I just wanted to let you know that we will be talking with Scott one-on-one after the question and answer period. Let's go back to the question and answers now. You're listening to The Horn, America's liberal voice.
Could prevent it.
Wow. I give the chance of war between the United States and Iran during the remaining period of George W. Bush's presidency an 80 to 100% chance of happening. This president has said that he will solve the Iranian problem prior to his leaving office. Now, a key element to solving a problem is defining the problem. And the president has done this for us in the 2006 National Security Strategy of the United States of America, where it lists Iran no fewer than 14 times as representing the number one threat to the national security of the United States of America. Not al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and the perpetrators of 9/11 who killed nearly 3,000 Americans and other human beings. No, that's not the number one threat. Iran is a threat, a nation that hasn't invaded another nation in 300 years. They're the threat. How so? First of all, the president says Iran possesses a nuclear weapons program. And he says that Iran is the largest state sponsor of terror in the world today. Now, I'll tell you right off the bat that there is no evidence whatsoever to sustain the president's allegations about Iran and a nuclear weapons program, that for 5 years the International Atomic Energy Agency has blanketed Iran's nuclear infrastructure with the most sophisticated on-site inspection teams the world has ever seen. And they've come back with a finding that says there's just nothing here to show that there's a nuclear weapons program. They have concerns, and they're investigating these concerns, but no weapons program. The other thing is, even if you say, well, we don't need data, we know they intend to do so. Well, I'm just confused about intent. You'd like to have a statement or some documentation to back this up. And again, we're lacking either of those. But let's buy for a second the notion of intent. They intend to do it. When? The CIA says that Iran is up to 10 years away from having a nuclear bomb. Ladies and gentlemen, Charleston, West Virginia is 10 years away from having a nuclear bomb. My hometown of Del Mar, New York is 10 years away from having a nuclear bomb. There's not a spot on the earth that isn't 10 years away from having a nuclear bomb. You can start from scratch today. And in 10 years, if you put enough resources to it, you can have a nuclear bomb. So that 10-year assessment means they got nothing. We don't know of anything. What's the urgency here? What's the urgency? Why do we have to act now? Is it about a threat to the national security, or is it about politically motivated ideologies? And I would say that a war with Iran is more about ideology. The largest state sponsor of terror in the world today, you'd be hard-pressed to demonstrate that Iran fits this topic. You can talk about Iranian support of Hezbollah. That constitutes a problem if you're an Israeli living in the northern part of Israel. You can talk about Iranian support of Hamas. That's a problem, again, if you're Israeli or if you're part of Fatah. You can talk about Iranian support of Iraqi militias. That's a problem if you're Iraqi or American troops in Iraq. But to say they're the largest state sponsor of terror in the world today is sort of a stretch, because, first of all, none of the things that I just talked about fit your classic support definition of terrorism. I mean, if you take a look at United States Code, and the definition of terrorism set forth there, and apply it to much of what the United States does abroad, we become, by definition, the largest state sponsor of terror in the world today. So I hesitate to put those titles on the Iranians so haphazardly. But we have done so. And now how has Congress responded? Congress has passed a resolution which calls the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command a state sponsor of terror. And if you read the two current war powers resolutions, the one about Iraq in 2001, or about Afghanistan in 2001, Iraq 2002, the fine print says that the president can use military force as he sees fit to respond to state sponsors of terror, non-state sponsors of terror, individuals, organizations who are involved in terror. And now the Senate has classified a major organ of the Iranian armed forces as a state-sponsored terror. They all they've done is drafted up a target list. This president will go to war against Iran unless something prevents him from doing so. I used to believe that Congress could prevent him from doing so, but we just saw that Congress punted. Right now, I pin my hopes on Turkey. Why would I want to pin my hope on Turkey? Because the Turks are probably going to invade Iraq to deal with terrorism, real terrorism, the PKK, going over the border, killing Turks, etc. We're asking the Turks to show restraint. But we're not going to show restraint on Iran. But if the Turks go into northern Iraq, it will create a debacle in Iraq that will probably make it too difficult for the United States to consider a war with Iran. This isn't a good thing. This is a bad thing for the Turks to go into Iraq. But other than some sort of unpredictable event right now, this administration has paved the way for a military assault on Iran sometime early next year, prior to the summer elections. Next question.
Why won't the White House comment on Israel executing preemptive airstrikes on Syria?
It's a good question for the White House, but the president refuses to answer it. I think, to be honest, and I'm not often in the position of defending the White House, I don't think they had much of a choice on this one. I think the Israelis did it. And the White House has been put in the position of having to defend Israeli action. Which aspect of that's getting booed? Oh, my anti-Zionist. All right. I mean, that's curious. I don't know where you were in 1991. Were you in Tel Aviv or in Western Iraq with me hunting down missiles? Did you spend 4 years in Israel like I did, working with three successive prime ministers to stop Iraqi WMD from threatening Israel? Don't call me anti-Zionist. Don't call me anti-Israeli. Call me a friend of the Israeli people. And there's a friend. I operate under the premise that friends don't let friends drive drunk. And when I see a nation drunk with power and arrogance driving off the cliff Forgive me if I try to reach in and pull the keys out of the ignition. And when we speak of Israel and the role that Israel plays today, as critical as I am about the United States seeking to impose its will, 300 million people imposing its will on 6.8 billion others, I likewise am a little concerned when a nation of 7 million seeks to impose its will on hundreds of millions of neighbors. Israel needs to learn to peacefully coexist with its neighbors. There is no excuse for preemptive military action, especially when the intelligence is so slim. It's not as though Israel blew up a reactor. First of all, we don't know what Israel blew up. There's a lot of speculation about what was struck. There's some photographs out there that show a concrete building. So what? Why bomb it? What's going on? And the answer is that the Israelis have been trying to get the United States to take the threat of Iran seriously. They've been trying for some time now. And the United States has only recently stepped up to the plate, but there has been a hesitation on the part of the United States to launch military strikes against Iran. And the Israelis, by attacking Syria, have put a marker down on the table that say that preemptive military action can succeed and should be considered more actively by the United States of America. And that's what I think is taking place here, that you have the Office of the Vice President, Dick Cheney, empowered by presidential decree, an executive order in April of 2001, basically running secret policy outside of the oversight of the national security bureaucracy and Congress. You see, the vice president claims that because he is both part of the executive and the legislative, he is beholden to none, neither. He gets to classify anything he wants to classify, and there is no oversight. He rejects congressional oversight. He rejects oversight by inspector generals responsible for seeing what is classified. He makes everything secret. And the vice president has been seeking to make preemptive military action against Iran a reality. And so what I think is happening here is that we have a segment of the American government, the office of the vice president, working with a segment of the Israeli government to carry out a secret preemptive military strike. Listen to the foreign minister of Israel herself. She said, "What the hell is going on here? I'm the foreign minister. You never told me you were going to bomb this place." Nobody knew except a handful of people in Israel. And suddenly one morning the president wakes up and there's a blown up building and everybody's screaming bloody murder and he has to go out and defend it as best can. That's what I think happened with the strike in Syria. I don't think it was a nuclear reactor. I don't think there's any evidence to point that it was a nuclear reactor. I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that the North Korean heavy construction company that built a nuclear reactor in North Korea was trying to use its heavy engineering and cement and materials for an engineering project in Syria, and that the intelligence analyst picked up the name of the North Korean company, tracked a shipment to Tarsus, Syria, tracked that shipment to a construction site, and made the assumption that it has to be nuclear related, and they bombed it. And I think they were wrong to bomb it. I think it didn't help Israeli security one iota. All it did is heighten tensions. Again, as somebody who watched my fellow soldiers die trying to stop missiles from pouring down on Israel in 1991, I've said that the last thing I want is a situation to arise where more missiles are raining down on Israeli cities. And right now, Iran is equipped with hundreds of missiles. Hezbollah has missiles. And that if we don't manage this situation carefully, we will have a situation where Israel, my friends in Israel, will once again wake up to the wail of a siren that says you are seconds away from death and destruction. And if you call yourself pro-Israeli, that's a fate you simply don't want Israel to have. Diplomacy trumps military action almost every single time. Israel denies having nuclear weapons.
Those that they don't have.
France. Built Dimona.
What purpose does mercenary forces such as BlackRock serve in a representative democracy?
They should serve none. As somebody who is, has served his country in the military in time of war, that oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, means something. It's a serious oath. It also, the fact that I wear an American uniform with an American flag sewn on the shoulder means that I am an American doing the bidding of my country, as difficult as that bidding sometimes is. When I don't take the oath, when my paycheck isn't signed by the Treasurer of the United States of America, but rather by Eric Prince, a CEO of a corporation, my loyalties aren't to the Constitution. My loyalties are to the organization writing my check. I've worked with Tier 1 Special Operations Forces. These are elite commandos that oftentimes get tasked out to the Department of Diplomatic Security. And they train very hard to do this job. A lot of effort goes in to keeping your charge safe. You want to avoid conflict, and if you do get into conflict, you will use violence only when absolutely necessary to use violence. Blackwater, when it first was created to fill a void. There's only about 1,500 DSS agents. And when we went into Iraq, we had suddenly had this – that's to serve a global requirement. When we went into Iraq, we suddenly had a scenario where – because of the poor security, we had to have about that many additional agents just to deal with the problems of Iraq. And the decision was made not to train up new agents, but to outsource it, part of Donald Rumsfeld's revolution in military affairs, the same way we outsource logistics service support to fight a war, so that we have Halliburton serving meals to our soldiers as opposed to the old-fashioned Army cook. I don't know what kind of quality of food Halliburton serves up. The Army cook did okay. But, no, the first people hired were people who had done diplomatic security in the past. These were actually pretty hardcore commandos. But as the mission grew, first of all, you'd start to see these Tier 1 commandos leave because they were unhappy with the notion of being called mercenaries. These are honorable people. Today, if you take a look at what happened in September, the Blackwater crew was composed primarily of 20-something former Marines. And I love my Marines. They're not Tier 1 commandos. Marines are trained to do one thing and one thing only, and that's kill people. And when you put them in a difficult situation, they went back to their base tendencies, and that was to pour fire into any potential threat. And as a result, 17 innocent civilians died. There's no role for Blackwater or any organization like Blackwater in doing the bidding of the American people. And so long as American troops are in Iraq, they're there on behalf of the American people. If we don't want them there, then we should get them out of there. But as long as they are there, they should be beholden to us and, more importantly, accountable to us. They have to be paid by us, and they have to do what we tell them to do. But when Eric Prince sends in his commando force, they operate as a law unto themselves. These son of a, you know what, actually disarmed an Army patrol. A U.S. Army patrol was disarmed in Baghdad by a Blackwater security detail. Now, I can't think of any situation that would justify mercenaries. Well, now we're going to find out. Fortunately, or unfortunately for 17 Iraqis, but fortunately for, I think, the integrity of America, we do have a situation where a review is being held. Now, the problem comes, as politicians always do, they'll seek to sweep it under a rug. We just had a high-level resignation take place in the Department of State, and some people will say, well, that's enough. No, it's not enough. And as much as, you know, I don't want to bring bad deals down on Americans, those trigger pullers of Blackwater need to be charged with murder, because that's what they committed in Iraq. It was murder. There was no justification for it whatsoever. And, you know, the ultimate insult came when the families came up to the State Department and the families tried to bribe, buy them off. You know what the value of an Iraqi life is? $12,500. Now, one Iraqi, they said, what do you want? He said, well, I want to be compensated. How? Like Lockerbie. You remember Lockerbie, don't you? Pan Am jet that blew up. You know what we said the value of an American life was? $8 million. So if we demand a payoff to each American family of $8 million for the loss of a loved one, I think the least we can do for the Iraqis we murdered was hand out a similar payoff. But no, we don't view Iraqi life to be as valuable as an American life. It's only worth $12,500. Next question.
As a frequent war protester, do you think I'm being overly paranoid to believe the detention camps that Halliburton has a contract to build will be used for us if and when Mr. Bush declares martial law?
Yeah, I think you're paranoid. I don't think we're anywhere near that yet. I don't know about West Virginia, but I know where I live in New York. I got enough rednecks with guns that it ain't never going to happen. All right, they can bring Blackwater in, they can bring anybody they want in, but the day you start rounding up American citizens and putting them in a concentration camp is that, you know, they don't have to, though. See, this isn't Nazi Germany. This is the United States of America, and we don't need to round them up and put them in concentration camps. All we have to do is put Dancing with the Stars on TV or American Idol on TV or some other reality program on TV, and you'll see that the mass of American people will dissipate and get locked into the narcotic of televised entertainment. Halliburton did. Yeah, okay, and I'm not going to deny that. We know that happened. The question was, as an anti-war protester, do I have to fear being rounded up and put in the Halliburton camp? And I would say no. You don't. Not yet. I don't think we're there yet. If we're there yet, they're going to be breaking up this. Okay? Again, everybody's human, and I know one thing. If we all walk across the river that's out here, we all have one thing in common. We're going to sink. Because ain't none of us named Jesus, and none of us are perfect. So forgive me if I make an occasional error in judgment. But what I will say is this. The frightening thing isn't that they're going to round up us war protesters, especially when we're white. All right? It hasn't come to the point yet where this president has the courage to round up a large number of white people and put them in a concentration camp. All right, so the fear that I have is that I and other white protesters are going to be rounded up. The fear is that so many white Americans are going to turn a blind eye to the injustices that are taking place against non-white Americans, especially if they are Muslim, brown-skinned, and profess to read the Quran instead of the Bible. That's the problem. Now, we say, well, they're just Muslims. No, they're American citizens, and if you've read the Constitution, you need to understand that the rule of law applies to all. And the moment we allow the government to infringe on the rights of one segment of American society, basically it's free game on the rest of us. So let's defend all Americans with the same, you know, level of intensity that we seek to defend ourselves.
Please comment on the power of corporations today and what we can do to control them.
Gosh, I don't know. We're a capitalist society. I don't know where most of you get your paycheck. We're in Charleston, so you might get it from the government or something like that. But corporations, they run the economic machine. I mean, all you college students, when you graduate, you want to get the jobs, do you not? You want to get the paycheck, do you not? Of course you do. Corporations are a reality. How do you control them? You control them through the rule of law. And the way you make sure that the rule of law serves the best interests of we the people is for us to actually get involved in electing representatives who are more beholden to we the people than they are to the corporations that write the checks to get it. So the key what I'm talking about here is a notion that we need to start collectively embracing. That's of campaign finance reform. We have to make sure that corporations no longer dominate the way in which we elect our officials, the government.
A Are we building permanent military bases in Iraq? If so, does the construction demonstrate that the invasion of Iraq was on a pretext?
Well, there's no doubt that the invasion of Iraq was on a false pretext. They're building facilities that can be called permanent. Enduring facilities. How many Vietnam War veterans we got in here? Remember Cameron Bay? That was a permanent facility, was it not? That was a heck of a facility. We poured a lot of concrete in Cameron Bay. We were going to hang around Cameron Bay for decades. I think they finally finished Cameron Bay around 1971, 72. By 1975, it was in the hands of the communists. So I'm not too worried about the concept of permanent military facilities because, as I've said over and over again, we have lost this war in Iraq, and it's just a matter of time before we leave, and no amount of pouring concrete is going to reverse that. But what we have to pay attention to is the fact that by pouring this much concrete, it shows the intent of the Bush administration. And the intent is not simply to resolve a difficult situation in Iraq, but rather to seek, as the officials have said over and over again under sworn testimony, regional transformation of the entire Middle East, inclusive of regime change in nations that we have designated to be incompatible with the American vision of what the Middle East should be like. And that's what bothers me, because this shows that the Bush administration isn't trying to solve the problem of Iraq, but rather broaden the definition of the problem we face in the Middle East.
When George W. Bush says the Constitution is only a piece of paper, and the law, we know what kind of paper, and the law is what I say it is, do you believe he will step aside after the election of 2008?
Bush is an arrogant man, and he surrounded himself with lawyers who have convinced him of the primacy of the notion of the unitary executive, that basically being that the president has sort of supreme powers, especially during time of war. And that's what he's talking about. He's saying in a time of war, I am solely empowered with the decision-making capabilities when it comes to national defense, and that, the Constitution, it's just a contract. It's contract law, and it can be renegotiated, and that he's not going to be beholden to it, that it's not a suicide pact. You hear that all the time. The Constitution is not a suicide pact. I disagree. It is a suicide pact. If you're an American, the Constitution's worth dying for. And we've got graveyards filled with crosses and Stars of David and other symbols of the brave men and women who have made the ultimate sacrifice in defense of the Constitution. So, now, with all due respect to the president, he's just dead wrong on this. But I'll also tell you this, that his lawyers and he and Dick Cheney, they try and stay in office one day after the election. You'll see them frog marched out of the White House by a brace of U.S. Marshals, because the Constitution still is relevant, and we haven't given up on that yet. I don't think we're allowing him to chip away at the base, but we haven't gotten to the point where it's just going to fall down. I don't think this president is that dumb to try and take on the ire of a nation.
Let's do a couple more, Scott. Do you feel the camera webs over American cities violate the intent of the Fourth Amendment?
That's a heck of a question. the cameras violate the intent of the Fourth Amendment, illegal search and seizure. I'm just not enough of a lawyer to actually get into the illegal. What I'll tell you is a citizen. I don't want in my home. I don't want the government in my home. I don't want the government reading my mail. I don't want the government, intruding on my privacy. But when I step out into a public spot, I'm no longer in my privacy. I'm interacting with my fellow citizens. And we live in a day and age where there are people out there who seek to do harm to us. And I do believe that just like having a police officer sitting on the side of the road with a radar gun is an infringement on my Fourth Amendment, having a camera properly utilized for our security is not an infringement. What I don't like is the notion of a secret Department of Homeland Security that is gathering data. If you're just monitoring a camera, that's one thing. But if I'm collecting images and I'm collating those images with warrantless wiretap surveillance, and I'm collating that with black bag intrusion on houses, and I'm building up dossiers not on foreigners who are intent to blow up a building, but on Americans who are intent on opposing policy they consider to be bad, yeah, that's a violation. I'll tell you what, when the government shows that it's worthy of the trust and confidence that I impose on them, I'll support this kind of camera network. But right now, with this government the way it is today, I can't support it because this government has shown that it's incapable of collecting data in a responsible fashion. The Department of Defense has used force protection as an excuse, force protection of military forces as an excuse to infiltrate anti-war demonstrations and collect data on people who are simply implementing their First Amendment right of freedom of speech. This government can't be trusted with something like that. So until which time we the people elect those representatives to higher office that truly represent our best interests, I don't think we should be considering a nationwide or citywide or any sort of comprehensive video surveillance, because this government can't be trusted with that power at this point in time.
Absolutely. One more, Scott. How should the U.S. proceed with regard to Iraq?
The million-dollar question right there. How do you? Yeah, that's a tough one because I think everybody knows where I stand on this war. We shouldn't have gone to war, that we went to war on false pretense. And I think that's been proven out. There was no WMD in Iraq at the time of the invasion. The CIA says all the WMD was destroyed in the summer of 1991, and it was. There was no link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, the organization that actually attacked us on September 11, 2001. But here we are, 4 years down the road. And frankly speaking, none of that matters at this point in time, especially for the 160,000 American service members who are over there in Iraq. What matters is today, the now, what's going on. There's a lot of people say, you know, maybe we shouldn't have been there, but now that we're there, we sort of broke it, we own it kind of philosophy, the pottery barn rule. I don't know. That's sort of a disservice to the Iraqi people. We broke it. Maybe we don't know how to fix it, and we might want to let them try and give it a shot, free of outside interference. You know, the American generals themselves have said that 80% of the violence, of the points of friction that manifest themselves in violence that kills Americans and Iraqis is directly attributable to the occupation of Iraq by American forces. So if I stood here tonight and told you, I got a solution to Iraq where I can reduce the level of violence in 6 months by 80%, would you not think that would be a stroke of genius if I could pull it off? But then I say, well, it requires us to pull the troops out. You say, well, that's betraying the troops. And now we come back to, is it really betraying the troops? Is putting the fire out betraying the firefighters? Is preventing the fire from starting to begin with betraying the firefighters? Ladies and gentlemen, we will not prevail in Iraq. We have already lost the war in Iraq. And like Vietnam, where our generals recognized that it was a losing cause as early as 1966, and yet we continued to send our youth over to fight and die for another 6 years, I ask you to reflect on this. How many people have been to the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C.? Imagine if you could go there and stand before it and blink your eye and make 1972 disappear. What if we had gotten out in 71? Imagine how many names suddenly disappear from that wall. Then blink your eyes again and say, what if we got out in 70? How many more names disappeared? Then blink it again, 69, 68, 67, 66. And look how small that memorial becomes. You want to know what we should do in Iraq, ladies and gentlemen? Ensure that we have the smallest war memorial possible with as few names on it as possible. We already have 3,800 plus and growing. Every day we stay in Iraq means we're just going to be chiseling more names onto that memorial. And it's not just American lives. Again, we come down to this hubris of America. 3,800 and growing. Try 1 million and growing. That's the number of Iraqis that have perished since we invaded in March of 2003. Think of the irreparable harm we've done to that nation, its culture, its society, that region, the world as a whole. And then reflect that the longer we stay in Iraq, the more harm will be done. Ladies and gentlemen, what should be done about Iraq? Get our troops out now. Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you so much. Scott Ritter, everybody.
Okay, so here's the deal. You've been listening to an address by Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector, man who tried to prevent the Iraq war. He's been speaking this evening on the campus of West Virginia State University in Institute, West Virginia, not too awfully far from the state capital of Charleston, at the invitation of a group called Seneca 2. In the past, they've had forums on Bush and the Constitution, and some several months back, they also welcomed journalist Dar Jamal to the campus of West Virginia State.
tonight's address was quite interesting, quite fiery. And we hope that, well, there's a bit of a reception line right now. And we, me and that mouse in my pocket. God, I sound like such a broadcaster. As soon as he's done with the reception line, I imagine that he will be coming back and we'll be engaging in a brief conversation, or at least that was the plan before this all began. And a chance for you, perhaps, if you are in the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room, or if you want to email bob@HeadOnRadio.com if you're not in the chat room. If you have questions for Scott Ritter, let me know what they are, either in the chat room or on or by email, and I will certainly convey them to him. Because I'm broadcasting directly from West Virginia State and not going through the West Virginia studios, we aren't able to take calls. So, you know, sorry. But, you know, that's one part of the technology that we don't quite have worked out yet. If you listened to the vast majority of the address, you heard some pretty stirring words. You heard him say outright that, you knew beforehand what his position on the war was, what it has been. You know the smear jobs that have been attempted against him as a result of his position. They did some of the same sleazy stuff to Scott Ritter that they did to Valerie Plame Wilson. Yeah, that's why I keep coming back to the assertion that we're not dealing with evil geniuses in the Bush administration. We're dealing with common street punks, thugs. Because they've got one play in one playbook, and they use it over and over and over and over and over. Smear, 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 smear. It couldn't be any more obvious. It couldn't be any more plain. But you know that he is uncomfortable with the status being accorded to the Constitution at present. He also said he doesn't think we're at fascism yet. I think that is largely a question of degree. By at fascism, do we use as the benchmark standard of fascism Kristallnacht? Then, okay, we're not at fascism yet. Do we use as a benchmark standard of fascism the complete and total marriage of the machinery of the corporations and the state? Then it certainly comes out as a different result in the equation. So I'm hoping we'll get to discuss that here in just a little bit. Also, this was the total multimedia experience this evening. Shot a photograph of Mr. Ritter and myself, and I've transferred it, I think, I hope, maybe, to our good friend ELO in the chat room, as well as to Agnes. I don't know if that thing has arrived yet, or maybe I just screwed it up. You know, that's entirely a possibility. I about halfway screwed the broadcast up getting it started. So, you know, these things happen. But it was a total multimedia experience because in addition to carrying this live to the entire globe via the Head On Radio Network, we also recorded it for later broadcast and soundbite excision. In addition to that, we videoed it. So at some point in time, as soon as I crawl the learning curve that is required for it or get some help from our intrepid chief engineer in Sydney, Australia, John Fox, we will begin to load some of this onto YouTube or Google Video or, any of the other places where we could possibly get it seen. I can imagine, for instance, that perhaps David Swanson over at AfterDowningStreet.org might be interested in some video clips here. So it was quite interesting for me, and I don't get out to do this enough to really, really get it all down just a do it with your eyes closed, blindfolded science. But, you know, little by little, bit by bit, we do figure it out. I've got other things that I do want to ask Scott about, because his area of expertise is obviously foreign relations. The exchange that he had with one member of the audience regarding his position vis-a-vis Israel said a lot. And I want to, this will be the first chance, assuming, you know, quite frankly, this is me drumming my finger on the table. Hear that? The reception line is still kind of long up there. What I'm doing now is called vamping. But at any rate, I haven't had a chance to ask a real, live, honest-to-God, international relations, foreign policy expert kind of guy the in-depth stuff about the coming war with Iran. That probably was the most stirring and stunning assertion that he made during the during the address this evening. Namely, that he anticipates we will be in a hot war with Iran by summer. And I tell you what, friends and neighbors, if that doesn't make your bowels turn to water, then there's something wrong. A hot war with Iran by summer. That's terrifying. That's death. That's death on a massive war crimes sort of scale. That is, well, we've talked about it before. That's babies that are in the womb right now who will be shattered by concussive blasts, plastered to walls, toddlers playing on playgrounds that will be slaughtered in an attack on Iran. That's what we're dealing with. That's what he's talking about. That's what we have a moral imperative to use every fiber, every sinew, every ounce of our beings to stop. Stop it for yourself. Stop it for your neighbors. Stop it for your own children. Stop it for your friends and your family who are already in an overstretched, damn near broken military as it stands. Because, as Scott Ritter noted, they will go and do what they are told to go and do. Whether they like it or not. It's something straight out of Longfellow or I forget, the charge of the light brigade. Ours is not to question why. Ours is but to do and die. And onward into the valley of death rode the 400,000, 4,000, what? You get the picture. You get the idea. So, you know, there we are. It's sobering, to say the least. Let's see if perhaps just because I want to find out if we're going to get Scott back here, we'll keep going. If not, I don't. You know, we've got to rerun our good friend Peter Godbold, the world's most fabulous conversation radio host. He of Strictly Confidential is a tad under the weather, so he's taking a break this evening. So with that in mind, we have a rerun ready to go. I don't want to subject you to me just sitting here babbling away if you don't have to put up with it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to see. I don't know. We'll get a little bit of music of some sort going, and I'll wander up to the front of the room and see if we can find out whether we're going to be able to have a little bit of a chat. I certainly hope we can. In the meantime, let me see. What have I got here? Let's find a little tunage. Don't have a lot of music on this this particular computer. So, yeah, this will do. Now, wait a minute. Got to learn how the magic buttons work. Here we go. So just sit back and enjoy some tunes for a minute while I go up and see if we can get Mr. Ritter behind a microphone for us. I'll be right back. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to the true definition of new media. You're listening to The Horn. And I'm Bob Kincaid. Music no working. I'll be back in a minute. Listen to the crowd noise. Talk amongst yourselves. Well, with any luck at all, we'll have Scott back here with us in a few. One of the lovely ladies from Seneca 2, I think, is going to go and strong-arm him back here. I want to see that happen. I shouldn't have put the video camera away. This is an interesting, a very interesting little group, Seneca 2. They've managed, like I said, to bring some fascinating people down here to the campus of West Virginia State University. And I don't know. I don't know who they'll get next. I've got a feeling it'll be interesting, though. So we will. I guess you. Yeah. So much for the crowd noise. They came and took the microphone away. What are you going to do? You know, I hesitate to run off on any other topics or tangents while we're waiting here. Simply because I don't want to change my own focus, my own train of thought. But, well, there are a couple of stories out there that sort of grabbed me. This is, well, I can patter, but it, somehow or another, after what I heard this evening, what can I say? The starch has sort of gone out of me. This was a very, very sobering, sobering conversation. The reception line is drawing down, and we'll wait and see. You know, flip a coin. Huge, huge room full of people tonight. Every bit of 150 to 200 people for this address, which is quite significant, really. When I first got here, they had just a few chairs set out. Didn't expect nearly the crowd that they wound up getting. Had to expand the room, fold the walls back, that kind of thing. In fact, I was at the rear wall of the event when I got here, and I was smack dab in the middle of the event by the time it was over because of the overflow crowd that came in. The event was also co-sponsored by West Virginia Patriots for Peace, who posted banners, and I took video footage of them with statistics. And again, I've used the word sobering. And in this particular instance, you want sobering. One day of the Iraq War, one day, equals 423,529 children in America having health care. One day. So 10 days is 435,290 children with health care. 20 days, you know, do the math. In other words, since we talked about the S-chip veto so much in the last couple of weeks, 423,000, and they're folding up the banner now, 423,529 kids with health care for one day of the Iraq War. You know, that statistic really, really does bear out the duplicity, the mendacity, and dare I say it, the outright evil of the Bush administration. George Bush is howling and whining for his war supplemental now, and yet he had the unmitigated gall to say that we didn't have $35 million to fund health care for America's middle-class children, working-class children, for 5 stinking years. Does the full gravity of that just assault your senses like it does mine?